This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Positively minded life nowadays, boy, pretty tough thing to get. Sometimes in order to get your mind positive, you have to ask yourself, what should I do? What should I do? I was just interviewed by the New York Post, who was asking me what's the effect it's having on people, the stress that people are having as a result of some of these financial swings that are taking away many of their securities. I mean, your securities are kind of withering. You know, you used to trust your banker, trust your broker, trust your accountant. Well, they didn't make right decisions, obviously, because nothing was protected. Now you have to trust yourself. But it's hard to trust yourself when you don't trust yourself. It's hard to believe in yourself when you don't believe in yourself, which leads me, or led me, to a fascinating subject I saw, which was a book called Procrastination Nation. Procrastination Nation by Gloria Aronson. I've invited Gloria to be on the air with us to talk to us about people who put things off consistently and can't make decisions or can't seem to make decisions and what's behind it. Gloria, are you with us?
I sure am.
Oh, beautiful. Good. Gloria, let's talk about it first. Procrastination, not making a decision, indecision. Is that the same thing or different?
Well, I think procrastination can cover both, but it also covers non-action. It's not just about the thinking. It's also a lot about the not doing.
About not doing?
Yeah.
I mean about not making a decision.
Not making a decision. Well, procrastinators make decisions. They just don't follow through. Take my husband. I feel like, you know, I feel like any young man. Take my husband.
Take my husband.
I've been married for over 30 years to what used to be, I would call him a third-degree procrastinator.
And you were never able to make the decision to get out.
That's covered in the last chapter of my book, How to Stay Married to a Procrastinator.
But
he makes decisions all the time. He has lots of projects that he wants to do. And it's really interesting because either he doesn't quite finish or he just keeps putting it off. I'll just tell you a funny story. A number of years ago, my husband had to have some very serious surgery. And while he was recuperating, he's an artist. While he was recuperating, there was a project he had been putting off for about 15 years, and that was creating some paintings to hang on the living room wall. So during his recuperation, he became very creative, and he figured out exactly what he wanted to do, and then he got well and had to go back to work. Well, that was 4 years ago. So on my living room wall, I have 3 empty canvases. When people ask what they are, I'll tell them they're modern art. They're really still waiting to happen.
You say that false beliefs are what drive procrastinators.
Yes. What really drives procrastinators is fear. And the false beliefs are the rationalizations that keep that fear in place. And the most common rationalization or the common belief is failure is unacceptable. And so from that, we realize that if I complete this project, if I go ahead and finish whatever it is, I could be a failure because it wouldn't be good enough.
A failure. The idea of I am a failure. It's like somebody who gets a divorce. I've heard people frequently say, I'm a failure because the marriage failed. I can't get out because I'm afraid of facing the marriage failed.
Right.
And it's like you're right. There's a stigma about failure itself. Now, you know, when you think about people who are artists who may go on auditions, they certainly don't have this because, you know, you're not going to get accepted in an audition, so you go for 1,000 auditions and you get turned down. You can't consider yourself a failure unless you've done it for 40 years, you know, and you haven't gotten your show yet, you know. But you have to have a temperament that says, I'm allowed to try and not succeed, that doesn't make equal failure with a lack of success at something. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
the word failure is a funny word. What does failure mean?
It's all in our interpretation of it. You know, I had a client once who won a Grammy, and then he couldn't write songs anymore because they had to be hits. So here's someone who, on the one hand, wasn't afraid of failure until he really had a success, and then it triggered that fear that anything less than this kind of achievement is unacceptable to me.
So there is one kind of procrastination that I've seen take place. I know of a great author, published a book 20 years ago, and she did this wonderful book. But now everybody was expecting so much of her that whatever she would put out, she was afraid the book wouldn't work.
Well, there we are. There's the fear.
You know, she's afraid. So she wound up holding off for 20 years and wound up losing her contract as a result of the fact that she was afraid to match up to it. So sometimes you might be somebody who was decisive at one point, but because there's no consequences for failing.
Yeah.
But then when the consequences get big, when you see yourself having big consequences, then you may become a procrastinator. Now, isn't this all based on face? How you look to other people?
No, it's often how you see other people. Because there are people, you know, a child or a young person, well, you know, I'll tell you a story about me, and I was in college at the time. I'm not a procrastinator, but I talk about how procrastinators are perfectionists, and I must say that that's a problem I've dealt with. But I was in college. I was taking ancient Greek, and ancient Greek is Greek to a lot of people, and every morning the teacher would stand up in front of the class. The class consisted of 5 people, so you couldn't hide out. You had to do your homework. And she would tell us the grammar lesson for the day. And one day she looked at me and she said, "You have the stupidest look on your face." And that's because I was trying to translate everything into Greek. But, you know, that was many years ago, and I still remember it and feel embarrassed. So
being shamed at any point could turn a person who might not necessarily be afraid. You can have a shock of shame, you know? It's like a shock of shame. There's another thing, too, which I think underlies most of this, and I think it underlies most neurosis. And I know you address it in your book, Procrastination Nation, by the way. Gloria Aronson is a family therapist, as well as quite insightful and an author of quite a few other books, Aronson. Gloria, it's this very basic issue when you're a kid. Some way you figure out, how am I going to get people to like me, and how am I going to get somebody to love me? When you get overly concerned about how much people like you, you can easily get thrown into a world of procrastination and
absolutely
indecision.
And that's the second false belief. People will dislike me or ridicule me or exclude me or harm me if I don't do it right. And that's exactly what we're talking about.
And that starts early in childhood.
Of
I mean,
course.
People won't like me if I'm fat. People won't like me if I'm too smart. People won't like me if I'm stupid. If I look different.
But it also starts with our parents. You know, if we are doing things and our parents frown at us or punish us or tell us we're not doing it the way they want it to be done, and it may be that they are irrational or unreasonable, but when we're kids, that's God speaking.
So, yeah, I know parents who make faces.
Right.
You know,
right.
When they're critical, they don't say anything negative. They just make faces. And the child sees those faces and dreads them, says, ugh. There's that face.
And
you know,
then
she,
what happens is we make a decision that we never want anyone to look at us that way again. And if they do, then it triggers that old reaction of shame and fear.
Armand DeMille here with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to be on with you every day. Yet tomorrow we're going to be talking about relationship communication. Very interesting stuff, my friends. Be sure to tune in. Today we're talking about the nature of procrastination. And we're talking about the nature of it with Gloria Aronson. Gloria, this comment about how do I get people to love me? Do you think the bottom line is of all indecision is I'm afraid I'm not going to get loved or I'm afraid I'm going to get unloved? That's pretty bottom lining stuff.
Well, to me, it's really survival, which is the first.
Okay, so survival is first.
Right.
Survival includes people loving me.
Absolutely.
And if people don't love me, it goes back to my threat to my survival. What are the five false beliefs that drive procrastinators?
Well, we've discussed the first two. Failure is unacceptable, and people will dislike or harm me. The third one is the opposite. Success is dangerous. So if I complete this project, whatever that is, and I am successful, something terrible is going to happen.
Well, you know what that sounds like a lot? The ABDs, the all but dissertation people, you know, the people who write, there are so many people who go to school, they go for a doctorate program, and they get in a doctorate program, and they do everything but the final part, which is the dissertation. And they go through life with telling people, I'm a psychologist ABD, which is almost an apology for never having completed it.
Right.
And I think that that must relate to the fear of success.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because by being a doctor without a dissertation, an ABD, in a way you diminish yourself every time.
Yes. But the question we have to ask is, why? What is your fear that is so great that you would limit your life by not succeeding and having whatever it is you're dreaming to have? Then go ahead and do it.
What are the fears that people do have? If they were able to tell you, and I'm sure you've asked many.
They do. Yeah.
So if you ask somebody, so what's your fear? What's your great fear? They're going to give you some surfacey answer that doesn't.
No. They're not going to give me some surfacey answer. For instance, I recently dealt with someone who is trying to start a new venture and was very upset with himself about why he was procrastinating, because it certainly was costing him money. And that's one of the hallmarks of a real chronic procrastination habit will harm the person or some others. And that if you are harming your own life in some way or it's harming other people close to you, then you've really got a problem.
So if you're not getting income, are you harming other people?
Well, if you're married, you are, and if you're supporting a family. But not getting your dissertation could harm your career or not handing in papers on time, things like that.
So there are points in life where procrastination doesn't matter. If you have a creative, I know a man, Ralph, who might be listening, who likes to start many, many, many projects. He's a great craftsman. And he starts these many projects as a hobby. And he just doesn't get to completing them. He moves from one to another to another to another, but doesn't necessarily complete them. But there's no consequence for his not completing them because these are wood carvings that he likes to do.
Okay, but how does he feel about it?
Well, he kind of laughs at himself for procrastinating,
uh-huh.
But he also makes a lot of very decisive action in his life the rest of the time.
Yes, but you see, not everybody procrastinates in the same areas of their life, and nobody procrastinates about everything. So some people procrastinate more in their private lives. Some people procrastinate more at work. And so it's really compartmentalized. But getting back to success is dangerous. One of the things that I do with people is I play what I call the worst case scenario game, and I say to this person, I would say to this man, what are you afraid would happen if you completed this project? And they usually say, oh, I'd feel great. And I say, no, you're not listening. What are you afraid will happen if you complete this project? And the answers sometimes are, it won't be good enough, or then I'll always have to keep making things, or I'll have to keep working at this high standard. Or it could be an answer that leads us to another of the false beliefs, which I call, I'm afraid of what the future holds. And there was a woman in one of my workshops whose goal was to clean off her desk, which she would consider a success if she cleaned off this messy desk. And what she discovered when I said, what are you afraid will happen if you clean off the desk? Now, you know, most people think, hey, what's with the desk? She said, if I clean up the desk, I'll have to clean up my life, and I'll have to divorce my husband.
Yeah, that's an extension. You know the way we used to do that, there's a process, which is if people can't follow it with being able to identify the fear immediately with the help of a therapist like you, they might. There's a process called and then what? Which is like if you said to somebody, what do you do? And then they said, well, if I clean off my desk, and you say, and then what? And then my desk is clear, and then what? And then I'll notice that everything is clear, so I'll want to clear up my closet. And then what would happen? Well, I'd start cleaning up my house. So the and then what process very often will guide somebody to a place where they'll see, you know, for example, if you took somebody with phobias, what would happen if you didn't have your phobia? They would say, well, then I would feel free. And where would you go? I would feel free to travel. And where would you travel to? Well, I'd get on a plane and I'd go to Europe. And what would happen when you go to Europe? Well, I wouldn't be leaving my family behind. I wouldn't be calling them, and I wouldn't be in touch with my mother. And you can see the phobia gets tied up to leaving mom.
Absolutely.
So, okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
So identifying what's wrong is where you need help sometime, because I think you just can't ask yourself the question, what am I afraid of?
Because I agree with you.
I also think that men don't have as much of an experience of fear as we would like to have them identify. You know, so if you said to a man, most people, what are you afraid of? Certain personality types never feel fear. They feel hesitation, caution, you know, but fear is like when you're cowering in a corner and you're screaming, oh, the wall is falling down on me.
I don't have that problem, but I like your wording. And I think procrastinators are equally men and women, and all people have fears. And I think you're absolutely right. They might not react the same way to the word fear, and I may just switch to your wording, and then you know, and what happens next?
The word I like a lot is reluctance.
Oh, that's
so. What is your reluctance? You know, and that gives me a lot with, especially with men, who may not, to a man talking to me, want to say that they're afraid, but I'd say, what is your reluctance? And they would say, here, you know, I reluct. Rather than I'm scared.
Well, I like him what would happen next. And there was a man in one of my my 6-week classes, who was divorced and had remodeled his entire house all by himself. And he came to my class because he had 99% of the house done, and he couldn't, for some reason, figure out why he didn't put the knobs on the kitchen cabinets. And one night I said to him, Joe, well, and I use the word, what are you afraid will happen if you put the knobs on? And he thought about it, and he said, well, the house will be complete. I said, yeah, and then what? And he said, well, then I won't have an excuse for inviting people over. And I said, and then what? And he said, and then I'll have to get married again.
All for putting the knobs on the kitchen cabinet.
Yeah, so that's why I call that fear of the future. And, you know, in this political time, I think I might start calling it earmarks, because an earmark is something that legislators stuff into a bill that has nothing to do with the bill.
Mm-hmm.
So what marriage has to do with kitchen knobs, nothing.
Well, indirectly it does, of course.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we talk about the part, people blame themselves an awful lot, and they look at themselves and they say, I'm just weak of character because I'm afraid that people won't like me and there's something wrong with me because I can't make my decisions. But we learned enough to see that there are certain causes that are even chemical that take place in the brain, the neurobiology of the brain, that seems to have a lot to do with the very inability to make decisions. You know, just to let you know, we recently discovered that people who hoard things have a disorder of their, what was it, the Antigulus Singular Gyrus. And that,
yeah.
And that was hoarding, and that when they fed that medically, when they gave you some Antigulus Singular Gyrus food, you wound up not hoarding so much. It's amazing. I mean,
yeah.
We psychologists thought that we had the real corner on this. We can figure it out. It's all neurotic. It's all about
right.
your mother, right?
Well, you're absolutely right. And a lot of people with obsessive compulsive disorder do hoard. And people with attention deficit disorder also procrastinate because they get so scattered that they're constantly interrupting themselves and going from one thing to another, or also people with ADD frequently leave things out on top of surfaces rather than put them away. So it gets very messy.
So you can't, when you're thinking about the fact that there's a biochemistry here, what would you say is the biochemical component?
Well, I think for those particular people, and there's also something that was discovered in the 1990s, and that is that there's something called a thrill gene. And the way that the thrill gene operates is people who have this gene are attracted toward experiences that give them a thrill, and like skydiving and gambling, but also in their behavior as procrastinators, they will put things off till the last minute because that idea of, can I make it? You know, I had a client who owned his own business and very successful, but he never knew from month to month if he could pay his payroll. So every month was this gamble, like, can I make it? And so what happens is they develop a habit of procrastination, and they're totally unaware of the fact it's driven genetically.
There are so many games that are designed, you know, like a house of cards. It's like you build them, you're going to a point where it happens, and the thrill of the collapse of the cards, or the thrill of having something blow up, you know, or the pickup sticks and stuff like that, all of that tension seems to do something chemical, you know?
Yes.
It seems to give your body enough stuff to make you feel good, endorphins, cortisol, serotonin, whatever the cocktail is, dopamine. And you think that has a lot to do with procrastinators as well?
Just some of them. You know, I think it's only, you know, we can't say it's the majority.
Well, you have isolated the amygdala connection. Can you talk
yes.
about that?
Well, certainly. The way that I see it as far as why people keep doing this, I consider that it's a compulsion. And a compulsion means you can't stop doing it. You know, you hate yourself because you say, I'm so smart. Why do I keep doing this? I know better. And the way that it really begins is it starts in a part of the brain called the limbic system. And the limbic system, it's very interesting. There are two things about the limbic system that people don't know and should. And one is that there aren't any words in the limbic system. There's just emotion. And the other, which is really important to procrastination, is that there's no time. So the past and the present exist simultaneously, and we keep shuttling back and forth between the past and the present. And that's really what creates procrastination. So say that you're a kid, and you're, you know, like one of my clients in the first grade, and the teacher embarrasses you in front of the whole class, and it was a terrible moment in your life that you never forget. And in that moment of shame, you make a decision, and the decision is, I'm stupid. Well, what happens then is you develop a fear of that ever happening again. You just don't want it to ever happen again. And so you develop avoidance behaviors. And one behavior would be to keep a low profile so that you don't come under the scrutiny of the person who's going to embarrass you and criticize you. And as you go through life, any time there is a person or a situation that is in any way reminiscent of that first one, and this is not on a conscious level, this is on a, you know, on an unconscious level, the amygdala, which is the smoke alarm of the brain, will pick up on that, whether it's the frown on someone's face or a certain situation that's reminiscent of being of the first time it ever happened, and it will feel as if it's happening again. And the amygdala will put you in a state of fight, flight, or freeze, the way you felt the very first time it ever happened. And that reinforces the fear. And this continues all through our lives. And,
yeah.
And that's what causes procrastination. It's really the brain remembering an original awful experience.
Well, you know, that original awful experience has been hypothesized by some, like Stan Grof, to do with the perinatal matrix, meaning somewhere all the way back there when, before you were born, things took place in utero.
Yeah. Well, you know, a woman came to see me who was procrastinating going on a trip, and in general traveling because of her fears of being closed in an airplane. And when I spoke to her and asked her about her experiences, she had had some experiences in her life of freaking out when she was in enclosed spaces. And because I am somewhat knowledgeable about the pre- and perinatal field, I asked her, I asked her unconscious mind how young she could be the first time she felt that terrible, overwhelming feeling of not being able to breathe. And the answer was her birth. And as a matter of fact, she started to hyperventilate, and she looked at me and she said, "Oh my God, I was a breech birth." And because of the technique that I use in helping people to overcome fear called Emotional Freedom Technique, EFT, we treated the experience of her birth. And she was able to get on an airplane and fly after two sessions.
I imagine that must be deeply cathartic, based around some hyperventilation and deep breathing. That's the kind of work.
It's an acupressure technique.
An acupressure technique.
Yeah.
You know the work of Stan Grof, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah, he and I were friends a while back.
Yes.
So yes, I'm familiar with it, and it's very important because we find the links to early fear sometimes, and I have seen people relive something that looks like their birth.
Absolutely.
It looks like they're coming through the tubes again, you know?
Yes.
And this time coming through right. Because you're right, with a lot of parents, you know, I don't know how a baby would know it, but when you... I'm imagining what it's like sitting in the back of a car when your parents are screaming in the front of a car. Imagine what it's like being inside the belly of your mom,
when
all this stuff is going on. Who would want to leave?
Sure, and you obviously feel because of the, you know, when you're in the womb, you are subject to whatever mother's going through emotionally, which will change her chemistry.
We're going to take a short break, and if you stay with me, Gloria Aronson, you're going to be listening to our interim announcements, a little music, and then we'll continue with you.
Great.
Okay, stick with us. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
That's when you go. You're undecided now. Well, I guess I'll never learn, and I show it through. If you got a heart, and if you're kind, then don't keep us apart. Make up your mind. You're undecided now, so what are you gonna do?
The legendary Ella Fitzgerald. How's that for you, Gloria?
Oh, that was great.
Isn't that perfect?
Yeah.
You got to keep that as your theme song.
Yep.
Right? We're speaking with Gloria Aronson. This is Armand DeMille with The Positive Mind. In case you just tuned by WBAI 99.5 FM in the middle of your dial in New York City. Here we are. I mean, we're talking about some of the things that are important. And there Ella asked this big question, which a lot of women ask. A lot of people ask, will you please make up your mind, mister? Well, you know, if women are pressing men, could you please make a decision, please make a decision, please make a decision? Some men can't make a decision, and then some men just can't make a decision about you. And then some men have made a decision, but they're not telling you their decision. I want you for my sex partner, but I don't want you for my wife. You know, but I can't tell you that, so I'm telling you I'm undecided. So what do you do when you're on the other side of a procrastinator, nader? That's my question,
when
Gloria.
When you are the friend, lover, family member, co-worker of a procrastinator, well, the first thing that I tell to those people is this person is not basically lazy. He or she is not stupid. He or she is not bad. And he or she is not really sick. They're scared. Now, if you can just come from that one understanding, then it puts that other person in a whole new light. This is a person who is unaware that he or she is paralyzed by fear. Now, I think that leads to compassion. And once we start to have compassion, then that can change our relationship with the person.
Well, you know, Gloria, I understand what you're saying, but, you know, I've got to go with the fact that, very often if you're trying to sell your house and a person comes to buy your house and you're saying, I can't be sure if I'm going to buy your house or buy the other house, but they really have already decided to buy the other house, but they're not talking to you. Very often people will lie as behind indecision. So here you're saying, well, here my boyfriend I've been with for, the last 20 years, I keep asking him why he doesn't want to marry me, and he says he can't decide. The real truth is he doesn't want to do it, but he doesn't want to state the fact, and that's his fear. So now you look at him.
Fear. He's afraid of what's going to happen if he tells you.
Right. He's afraid of what's going to happen if he tells you. Right.
If you've been with him for 20 years, then you know what kind of person he is. You know, this does not apply to someone who comes to buy your house because you don't have a history with them, so you don't know what's going on with them. But when you've been with somebody day in, day out, or you know, for many years, you tend to see them act in a certain way over and over again. Now, in the case of indecision, the person who is the one left holding the bag because they're waiting for the decision has a choice. And, you know, in my book, I talk to these people and I say, you know, you need to sit down with yourself and you need to ask yourself. And when it comes to relationships, I think there's only one question. Can I accept this person as he is right this minute that he might never change? That's the only question. And if the answer is, I don't think so, then the person who's the non-procrastinator needs to decide what action he or she's going to take.
But what if they're a procrastinator?
If they're a procrastinator,
now they figured out, okay, I really figured it out. He doesn't really want to be with me the way I want him to be with me.
Well, you know, what I do is I talk about taking a history. And
very important, yes.
And what I do is I say to the, I mean, because I do this with my husband. You know, I watch him sometimes. I say living with him is like having my own laboratory up close and personal. And I'll say, you know, after what I do is when I get upset, I treat myself with EFT, which is raises the serotonin in the brain and calms me so I can look at this from another point of view. And I sit down with him when I'm calm and I'll say, you know, when I saw you do or not do whatever the other day, I was really puzzled because I'm not a procrastinator. And I can't figure out why you said you really wanted to finish Project X. But you did all these other things, and what was going on? And I do it in a sense of true inquiry, not in trying to nail him to the wall. And often by coming at it in a gentle way and saying, tell me, you know, and in my book I tell one of my favorite stories. I call it the Thanksgiving story. One Thanksgiving, when we were living in a house that didn't have a dining room but had a huge kitchen, we were having Thanksgiving, and as I was getting everything ready in the morning, my husband walked into the kitchen and said, oh, my gosh, we don't have matching chairs. You know, we didn't have a dining room set. And I said, well, no, we don't, but we've got folding chairs, or we've got assorted chairs. And he said, oh, we have to have matching chairs, and he disappeared. And he went out to find matching folding chairs. And I was left holding the bag with the Thanksgiving preparations, and I was just steaming. And one of the things I did was I walked into the guest bathroom, cleaned up, and I noticed that after he had put the wallpaper up in that new bathroom, he had forgotten to put the molding along the bottom of the wall, and we had this gaping area all along the wall. And I thought, I don't understand this man. Here he doesn't finish this job, and the molding is gone, but he's running out, going crazy, trying to find matching chairs. Well, after Thanksgiving was over, I sat down with him and I said, you know, I really have to understand this. I cannot figure out why you behaved that way. Well, you didn't finish the bathroom job, but you were so worried that the chairs wouldn't match. And he said, well, my mother was a stickler for propriety because she had very low self-esteem and it was important to her what other people thought. And he said, and so I just got into a frenzy realizing it didn't look right. And I said to my husband, well, you know, I was brought up in New York in a small apartment, and when we had company, we just pulled all the chairs in and, you know, including the piano bench.
Right, no two chairs ever matched.
Right.
It didn't matter.
We all had so much fun, and who cares?
Right.
So you see, when you're the non-procrastinator, you do not know the other person's complete history, even if you've been married to them forever. And you don't always know what makes them tick. And sometimes when my husband tells me the answers to these questions, it brings tears to my eyes.
Yeah, I understand. But, you know, getting to that loving, compassionate part where you feel the curiosity rather than the hostility, you know, okay, darling, I'd like you to sit down and tell me, why was it that you showed up drunk 4 hours late for dinner? You know, and I want to hear it from my inside of my heart. Very difficult for many people to do because they got to get past their annoyance and anger.
Well,
somewhere they have to get it. Now, you talk about using EPT or energy psychology technique.
Yes.
Could you, let's talk about what that technique is.
EFT is
EFT.
Acupressure, and it consists of gently touching or tapping 8 acupressure points, mostly on your face, and face and upper body and hands.
Could you describe the places?
Well, you know, on my website, GloriaAaronson.com, I have a diagram and instructions that people can actually access and print out.
Good. And for those of us who don't have computers because we're in New York.
Yeah. but I also described this in my last book, 5 Simple Steps to Emotional Healing.
Sure. The pressures that you put are over your brows?
Well, the first one is right on the outer edge of your hand. We call it the karate chop spot because that's the place that if you were breaking the brick, you'd hit it. And then we gently tap on our eyebrow where the hair starts to grow near the nose.
Then the eyebrow. But this is with your fingertips, right?
Just 2 fingertips. Then on the outside corner of the eye socket, on the outside, on the bone. Then under the lower lid, under the nose, under the lower lip, right under the collarbone, and then on the side of your body about 4 inches below your armpit. And those are basically the points that I use. And what happens is as we focus on the problem, not the solution, but on the problem, you want to focus on the discomfort, whether it's thinking about it, whether it's remembering an unpleasant event, or whether it's it's a negative belief. We focus on that as we tap these points, and it raises the serotonin in the brain. It also, when the serotonin rises, it floods the amygdala. So if a person is remembering an especially shamed moment or fearful moment, and the amygdala is flooded, it will eliminate the trigger that keeps this happening over and over again.
It's an interesting association. It's good to tap yourself on the brain when you get crazy.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like punching yourself up the side of your head, just a variation therein.
And it's tremendously relaxing. It really takes, I call it weed whacking. It takes the edge off anxiety, off fear, but it also actually does eliminate fears permanently.
Is there a way for a procrastinator to get to the root of the problem once and for all?
of course. And usually that's in going back. You know, what I do is I go from the outside to the in. So we start with the goal. You know, what is your goal? What is the project that you haven't started or you haven't finished? What is it that's troubling you? And then I usually ask people for their excuses because that's the place that people stop. It was too hot. It was too cold. I was busy. You know, I didn't have the money. And that usually gets them off the hook. And I say, no, that's just your smokescreen. Let's go to see what's the worst thing that you're afraid would happen. And that usually brings up one of the 5 false beliefs. And we didn't discuss the 5th one, which everybody knows, and I call it, I don't wanna and you can't make me. And that's left over from childhood.
The defiance.
The defiance against authority. So a great many people are procrastinating because of that, you know. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. I don't want to clean out my garage.
In a way, to say that I do what you say. So in other words, let's say we took away the defiance. if you'd lost your defiance, what would happen to you? If I lost my defiance, I would have to submit to authority. If I submit to authority, then I would be completely abolished, is the kind of thinking that goes behind that with people who are defiant. And in effect, you're talking about really dealing with early childhood fears. Because that's got to be a fear that comes out of early childhood.
Right.
I would be abolished if I don't defy.
Right. So one of the things that I do is I play a little game that I call the magic question, and I will ask a person, and how young could you be the first time you felt this, or how young could you be when you first decided the world is cruel? And this unconscious mind knows and will give an answer.
Wow, what a powerful question.
And you know, Armand, one of the most frequent numbers that people give me is two.
Two, I was going to say.
Two. I think that is such a crucial age.
Wow.
And most of us cannot remember age two.
Let's go back to that question. So here's the question. The question is, at what point did you decide what?
Decide that failure is unacceptable, or decide that I can't be better than my brother.
At what point did you decide? Well, I guess you're saying, at what point did you decide that you can't afford to be yourself?
That's right.
And for each person, if we would ask everybody in the audience right now to think about it, and we would do a mental survey, and we have a counter here which is going to light according to people's mental survey. Everybody send the energy, whatever the number is. You would say in general, as I would think, if people were to allow themselves to dip into it, at what point did you decide this world is not okay? If what point did you decide that you're not okay as you are in this world? I think most people would say 2 or 3 years old, even though they can't remember 2 or 3 years
right.
old.
Right.
It's remarkable.
Yes.
I know one young man who recently talked about being able to find a time when he felt a panic. And we were able to track him using some of the similar techniques that you use. And he remembered being a baby in a crib near an open window where mosquitoes were biting him. And he was crying, but nobody would pay attention, but the mosquitoes were supposedly having a field day. And when he checked it out with his family, he found out they were poor, they didn't have air conditioning, they lived up in Harlem, the window was open, they kept the baby as close to the window as possible for the air, and that there must have gone on because his aunt tells him about a time when he was terribly bitten. So imagine a baby's brain.
Right.
This is nobody's doing anything wrong. Maybe somebody's not listening to a baby screaming. But back in those days, very often you thought, if a baby's screaming, leave him alone, he'll get better.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So maybe nobody did anything malicious to make this happen. But at some point early on, he decided the world is not a safe place and there's nothing I could do about it.
And I, you know, that is one of the points in my book that makes it different from most procrastination books, which only talk about tips for changing your behavior in the here and now. It can go all the way back, as you say so beautifully, to that very, very early time and those very early decisions we make from being so little, and our brains, you know, we have no insight. And the world is dangerous. And, you know, I tell some stories in one of my chapters about people who went all the way back to childhood, one in which a woman's mother was very ill during the pregnancy and had to go away right after she was born, and they weren't bonding, and the baby decided, everyone who loves me leaves me. And that became the pattern of her life. You know, people who truly want to get to the heart of their procrastination may very well have to go all the way back to a much earlier time and to a decision that really is not necessary anymore.
Gloria, you're fine. It's nice to know, nice to hear your sensitivity, and nice to know. What part of California are you in?
I am in beautiful Santa Barbara.
Beautiful Santa Barbara. See, look it up with a B, right? For beautiful. Well, nobody needs therapy in Santa Barbara.
No, but I come from beautiful B, the Bronx.
Yeah, I thought you did. I heard a Bronx accent there. Yes, I do. Did you hear they just closed Yankee Stadium and they opened?
Yeah, that's where I live.
Yeah, you live right up there near the train tracks.
Yeah, you can see the lights.
Well, it's different now.
I know.
It's different now. I'm going to find somebody who's got a piece of it, and a piece of Yankee Stadium, and send it to you. You know, Gloria, you talk about if people can't go back, you know. I mean, is this as simple as, look, if you can't make a decision now and you have to make a decision, let's know one thing. Do not make a decision out of fear. Make a decision out of calm. Because nowadays, especially, people are trying to decide, how do I deal with the stock market? What will I do with my 401k, my retirement fund, my union fund? Should I sell it? Should I not sell it? Should I take out what's left and leave? Or should I take my money and just, you know, leave it there? And what should I decide? And everybody's advising you one way or another. And brokers are telling you, don't panic. But, you know, if you had panicked 3 months ago, you'd be far better off.
Well, you know, in my book, I have a little technique that can be very helpful, and I call it writing to Dear Abby, except you don't really write to Dear Abby. But what you do is you take a piece of paper, and you write as if you're writing to Dear Abby, I don't know what to do about this, and I'm in a quandary, and you write it as if you were writing to her. And then you turn the paper over, and you let yourself channel Dear Abby through your pen. And you write to yourself, Dear Joe, I read your letter with great interest, and I know there's an answer for you. And as you move your pen, it will be amazing what will come through you. And a lot of times, that in itself will calm you down so your own common sense and your own wisdom can come through and advise you.
Well, maybe the Dear Abby vision may not work, but how about a Dear Gloria?
Oh, that would be lovely.
You know, everybody can write their Dear Glorias, and you could even send them with your answers
to
Gloria Aronson. How about this for your research? So if you have a question about your procrastination, don't just write to Gloria Aronson and say, tell me what to do. Write to her as if you were writing to her, and then write your answer. And then send them on to Gloria, and you'll be part of her next book.
That would be great.
Yeah.
And they can contact me through my website.
The website is Gloria Aronson, AronSon.com.
That's right.
The book is Procrastination Nation. And here's a cheer from the Bronx for you, Gloria. Okay. And thanks for being on the air with us.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
Yeah, great. Nice to speak with you.
Bye.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. So, you know, it's not an easy thing. There are certain types of people who don't procrastinate. They get everything done, and then we're going to talk more later this week, maybe on Thursday. I'm going to continue with you to talk to you about different ways that people manage time. And managing time is not a simple matter. Some people manage it one way, and others manage it another. But maybe I have some good, helpful information. I'll do that on Thursday. Tomorrow we'll talk about relationships that work with David B. Wolf. And this is Armand DeMille with you. You can get a copy of today's program at thepositivemind.com, or you can call my office at 212-757-4488. Let's go out with a little Benny Goodman doing Undecided.